Welcome into the Original Gangsters Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Bernstein. We are going to be hitting on some breaking news as well as deep diving some other stuff that we reported that's connected to this breaking news a couple months ago. We're going to be talking about what could end up being the biggest sports gambling scandal in American history. Another domino has dropped in the last week or so. We know based on ESPN's reporting back in the late winter, early spring, that the reputed kingpin of this what looks like a sprawling point shaving scandal throughout the NBA and college basketball, a guy by the name of Shane Hennon, goes by the nickname Sugar Shane, has been arrested. It looks like he has been cooperating. And he has a history with what I will call remnants of the Pittsburgh Mafia. So I wanted to reach out to our resident Pittsburgh mob expert, Paul Hodes, who wrote a great book about the history of the Pittsburgh mob that came out in 24.
In 23, actually.
23. We had him on to talk about that. And now we're bringing him back on to not necessarily give us information on Hennon, because Hennon just popped up on all of our radars. I mean, this isn't a guy that we really knew about until ESPN outed him. But Paul's going to give us some color on the people that I've been able to connect to Mr. Hennon. Mm-hmm. Well, Paul, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, no problem. It's always great being on.
So we learned all about this. Well, it came in drips. We had been hearing throughout, I think, 23 and 24 about these individual point shaving allegations involving NBA and college basketball players. They were not all connected until ESPN's big story that came out, I think, in the last week of February, which tied them all together and named Hennon as the guy that was alleged to be quarterbacking this whole thing. Mm-hmm. The conspiracy is alleged to have taken place between 2021 and 2024. And we just got word in the last couple of days here in Detroit. I'm in Detroit that a former member, I guess now, of the Detroit Pistons, Malik Beasley, is the latest name to be brought into discussion regarding his alleged role in the scandal, which is point spread manipulation, and not just the spread on a game, but a lot of this had to do with prop bets. What a player within a, you know, it's like a game within a game, like said player is supposed to get 15 points and 6 rebounds, and you can bet that he's going to get over it or under it in that game. And it's easier to manipulate than an overall points. So Malik Beasley, his name has come into this now, not when he was with the Pistons, though the allegations are when he was with the Milwaukee Bucks in the 23 season.
Okay.
And there's been one conviction already. Jonte Porter, who was a member of the Toronto Raptors, he was convicted and has since been kicked out of the league. The same time that Malik Beasley's name surfaced, within, I think, 48 hours, the FBI came out and cleared another player whose name had been put out there, Terry Rozier, who was a guy that's on a $100 million contract. Wow. They were worried about some discrepancies or suspicious betting action on his prop bets for his, but he's been cleared of it. Beasley's the latest name to be brought into it. So that brings us to Shane Hennon, who is the alleged ringleader. And I've done some reporting on him since his name came out. And that's why I've come to Paul and wanted to bring Paul on to give some analysis to the people that he grew up around. And then just give some reaction to some of the stuff I've reported. I don't know what Paul has or hasn't consumed, but I'm going to kind of tee it up for him and then get his his insight and reaction. But let's first talk about what the Pittsburgh mob was like when Sugar Shane Hennen, a professional gambler, a tout, a guy that had a social media presence, selling gambling picks. He was out in Vegas when he got arrested, was living in Vegas, but came up in Pittsburgh, came up around a lot of familiar names. Guys like Junior Williams, Frank Yunus, Bobby Iannelli, Duff Conley, who just took a bus recently in the last month or two. What was the Pittsburgh mob like, Paul, in the two? So Sugar Shane is like 39, 40 years old. So he would have been coming up in the late 90s, early 2000s as a young man. What was, you know, this was after, this was right at the end of Mike Genovese's life. The Pittsburgh mob was kind of on, you know, life support.
So at the end of, you're right. So at the end of the 90s into the early 2000s, there were still a lot of gambling rings operating, which we'll talk more about since you've given those names that are allegedly connected to Hannon. Basically, you know, it's not the Wild West like the 80s and 90s where bodies are dropping in the streets and there's tons of drug dealing going on, you know, Colombian suppliers in Florida and all that. And you know, the gambling is really what was going on at that time. And like you said, the alleged Don, Mike Genovese, was pretty old by that time. He died in 2006. Of natural causes. And there were only really a few members left alive in the late 90s, early 2000s. Youngstown had just imploded because Lenny Strollo flipped. And that was really the kind of the last crew that I would say committed some, you know, pretty memorable violence in the late 90s. And then you had, you know, it went pretty quiet, but there were still gambling arrests. You know, as you mentioned, there's even gambling arrests pretty recently. So basically a lot of the guys that you mentioned were gambling associates, some of whom were pretty successful. And the family was still making money that way, but it wasn't.
Paul, we should explain to people, cause I've had some conversations with guys that are, I mean, I'm going to be frank, you know, made guys that I've talked to about this, from other cities. And these guys have a hard time understanding how Pittsburgh was, in the sense that pretty much after 1990, they stopped making guys. Yes. I mean, I would say since 1990, they stopped making guys.
Yep.
So for the last, let's say, 15 years of the Pittsburgh Mafia, you had no making ceremonies, and you had guys that, in theory, would have been made anywhere else and were treated in terms of stature, as if they were made guys.
Yes. Yes.
Well, you know, I think people have a hard time understanding how you can just, I think, and also tell me if I'm wrong in saying this, I get the feeling that this was a voluntary thing from Genovese, that he wanted to pull, you know, bring the curtain down on the mob family. He didn't really have an interest in continuing it past when he died. So it was just a much different, murkier landscape, but a lot of rackets. I mean,
yes,
a lot of gambling, a lot of drugs, a lot of Shylocking. So it wasn't a barren landscape.
No,
it just, there weren't a lot of made guys, but there were guys acting in a manner that if it had been a normal kind of functioning crime family, they would have been. So what we're saying is some of the guys that we're going to be talking about, if not all the guys that we're going to be talking about here, did not have buttons, but they were still very prominent members of the organized crime in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, exactly. Associates are very important in Pittsburgh, as they are in the mafia generally, but in Pittsburgh even more so. I mean, even in the 80s when there was a resurgence of activity, like, you know, you're only talking 15 to 20 members at most. And right. Some of those were like so old that, you know, they're literally like not doing too much at all, you know, retired in Florida, et cetera. So you have to think of the Pittsburgh family in that way. It was never like New York or even other, some other smaller families like Kansas City, where there was a ton of made guys. Being made was almost like being a capo in another family to my
mind. That's a great, I like the way you said it. When Sugar Shane Hannon, who's half Irish and half Italian, and the guys that we're going to be talking about here, Hennon's connection to them, from what I understand, ran the gamut. It was from guys that he was betting with, guys that he was working for, booking bets on behalf of, guys that he was collecting for, guys that he might have been dealing drugs with, or parts of their crew dealing drugs with. So it wasn't like he was officially under this guy or that guy. You know, he was a wild and crazy kid, has had a number of convictions on his rap sheet, bookmaking, drug dealing, assault. And I'm told that he had, let's start with the Williams crew. I'm told that he had some bloodline relation into the Williams crew, possibly through his mom.
Okay.
Well, if it was a cousin or an uncle, or he called somebody uncle, but it wasn't his uncle. But I'm kind of told that when he was a teenager and in his early 20s, Junior Williams and his guys were kind of, you know, teaching him the tricks of the trade in the world of the Pittsburgh rackets and gambling. Can you talk a little bit about who the Williams were?
Sure. And don't let their last name fool you. They are Italian. I believe the original name was Guglielmi.
Guglielmo.
Yeah, something like that. So basically, you had Adolph Jr. Williams, and then you had Salvatore Williams. And all the guys that you mentioned were connected in some fashion, laying off bets with each other. Their rings overlapped, et cetera. So, you know, once again, it's a small family. Everybody knows each other. But the Williams brothers were very powerful, made a lot of money, millions of dollars a year. I'm not sure exactly what their take was. The court docs and the articles are a little bit fudgy on that sometimes. But in the millions of dollars, making it off of numbers and sports bookmaking, et cetera. It appears, you know, they started to get on that law enforcement radar in like the 1970s. And then you have them really hit their stride. They were proteges of Tony Grosso, who was a very famous illegal gambling operator in Pittsburgh.
He was the policy king, right? He ran all the numbers.
In the
white Italian neighborhood.
And in the 80s, you know, it was alleged that he was making $30 million a year. And him and the Williams brothers were also allegedly running numbers and doing sports bookmaking in the black neighborhoods too. Right. So they were also doing policy there too. So those two, once Tony Grosso went to prison, the Pittsburgh Mafia seized that opportunity to sort of take that quasi-independent operation and take it over. And so they had to pay a higher percentage to the Pittsburgh mob for running those same rackets. And basically they did so for many years after Tony Grosso went to prison. They got arrested a few times. There was an arrest in 1990 that sent them away for a little while. And, you know, 1990 was a bad year for the Pittsburgh Mafia just generally. But there's also one thing that I mentioned in my book, where it's an anecdote of them basically taking over, once again, allegedly. They really haven't been convicted of any kind of serious crimes. They are passed away now, but no murders or anything like that. It was all gambling offenses. But there is this story in the book that basically Junior Williams and this guy named Robert Mancini were fighting over a neighborhood in Pittsburgh called McKee's Rocks. Basically just got into an altercation. And eventually, according to the story, it was in the media, Junior Williams, you know, started paying, some of the local officials more than this Robert Mancini was. And in order to fight back, Robert Mancini basically started to talk to the local authorities. They found out, and he was assassinated in his apartment.
Yeah, I was gonna say that. We want to be clear, but we also want to be factual.
Yeah,
the Williams brothers were never convicted or arrested or indicted in any homicides.
Nope.
But they were considered suspects in a handful of homicides from the late 70s, early 80s, one of them being the Bobby Mancini case. People are suspects in crimes they don't commit all the time.
Yeah.
Take it for what it's worth.
Yeah.
But they were implicated in being suspected in some acts of gangland violence. So these were not these were serious guys. I mean,
yes.
And then tell people about how, you know, the rest of the world kind of learned about Junior Williams in the 2010s or 2000s.
It was 2014, I believe. I know you're talking about the Godfather of Pittsburgh TV show, which I think is on Annie. Not the greatest show, but the one kind of cool thing it did have is that Junior appeared on there kind of as an advisor to basically like his
son. I think it was his son-in-law, wasn't it?
Son-in-law, yeah.
He ran a strip club
and was a legitimate businessman in other ways. But that only lasted one season and he appeared on there for a little bit.
I mean, I'll tell you, my snap judgment, which was wrong, when I was watching it, I was like, oh my God, they're trying to make something that's not there. And it kind of made Junior out to be a little bit of a cartoonish. And until I looked into it and I was like, oh, no, Junior Williams was a real gangster. Like, this guy was an OG. Yeah. Like, he's not something to be, play around with. So I don't know if it necessarily did him justice the way that they the narrative in the show.
A lot
of people didn't understand that this was actually a guy of some substance and stature. But the show, like you're saying, was more based around the son-in-law. He was supposed to be the godfather of Pittsburgh.
Yeah, exactly. And he died shortly after that in 2016.
Junior did, right?
Yes, Junior, not the son-in-law. And like you said, like for anybody watching that outside of Pittsburgh, they're not even going to know probably who Junior is. But in Pittsburgh, he was pretty famous. Yeah. They owned a lot of parking lots, too. That was one of their legit businesses.
Okay, so I'm going to save Frank Yunis for last because I think when we're talking about more recent stuff, I'm able to tie Shane Hennon into some of Frank Yunis's offspring. And we'll get into it in a moment.
Gotcha.
But I think now we're just talking about stuff that was going on when Sugar Shane was a young man. Everybody in the world of gambling in Pittsburgh knows Bobby I.
Mm-hmm.
He's in his 90s. He took a pinch in his 80s. Him and his son appear still run a bookmaking operation. He's 95, took a bus in 2019. And he goes back a long, long way. And he's in North Park, right?
Yes, yes. Right around a restaurant that family's owned for a long time called Chubb's Place.
Chubb's, right. And he was, for a long time, he was underneath Wango, Capizzi, and Sonny Amato.
Yes. And basically, when you're talking about him, and like I said, these guys are very closely connected, he took over after Tony Grosso was arrested in the 80s, a part of that empire. And, it's said, and especially in the Pennsylvania Crime Commission files and some of the other stuff I've been able to look at, that, he in the 80s and 90s had the largest sports gambling numbers ring operating in Western Pennsylvania. And these guys are connected to, Paul Hankish, too, in West Virginia. There's a lot of that going on. That's Frank Yunis as well. But like you said, like, you know, I don't know if he's doing it right now. I'll be honest.
No, I'll tell, in the coming minutes here, I'll color up what I've been able to report about what was going on in the months leading up to Hennin's arrest.
And you know, like, we have to remember too that the family didn't die in the early 2000s, you know, when Bobby Unelli was still very active. Obviously, you know, that arrest in 2019 that was just adjudicated in 2020. Like, there was still one maid member left at that time, Thomas Sonny Sansudi.
Right.
I don't know what their exact relationship was in that late period, but for my, you know, for the record, like, there was a remnant of a maid, the maid part of the family up until 2021.
I was going to say that
Nellies are like legendary gamblers. I mean, they've been doing it for decades and decades, you know, and they're continuing in a tradition that Tony Grosso started in the 1940s. I mean, it's a long tradition.
And I mean, I'll just put out there, you know, going by the letter of the law in La Cosa Nostra, if there's one maid guy left in your city, you're still considered to have a family. Now, there's in theory, and then there's in practice, there's something that you can say on a, maybe on a piece of paper, but when you actually put it into action, it doesn't necessarily stand. But as you said, Sonny was alive until a couple of years ago. So that brings me to another couple guys that were underneath Sonny that I'm told Sugar Shane, again, either bedded with or took action for. And that's Biscuit, Jeff Risha, and Ralphie Head Maselli.
Okay, yeah, and they were busted for the last time, I think in 2013?
13, okay, yeah, 13, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, and that was kind of on their own. And I'm pretty sure they were also involved in an earlier 2000-2001 bust with Sonny, where there was a big sports bookmaking ring that the feds busted up, which allegedly was basically the result of Chucky Porter, the old underboss, giving the FBI information that ring existed. And that was one of the last sort of benefits that they reaped from his cooperation.
So I just want to make sure that people understand the areas that we're talking about. Bobby I, we said North Park, that's like southwestern Pittsburgh.
So no, more in the northern section of it, like
Allegheny, Westmoreland.
Yeah, like northwest, like of the city. Of, if you're looking at downtown where all the rivers converge, like.
Okay. And we said Junior's area was kind of the McKees Rocks.
Yes.
The Hill, East the Hill End. District.
And then the last, you know, the last person, Eunice, who was Aliquip.
Right. We'll get to him in a second. With Biscuit and Ralphie Head, Allegheny and Fayette counties.
Fayette.
And then we mentioned Duffy, who was like a prodigy, from what I understand, was like a gambling prodigy, like from a very young age. He was brought into the mix by Mike Genovese, you know, kind of empowered as this. He was never to get made. He's Irish.
Yeah. Yeah.
He really trusted his acumen for gambling operations. He's not that old. I think he's in his mid 60s now.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Because like, when in the time frame that my book covers more thoroughly, he was definitely on the younger side of those guys. If I'm remembering correctly, came up first in the Ringcone Casino.
Right. And then
in 95, 96.
Yeah. I think he took his first pinch in the late 80s. I have it written down. Duffy took an arrest in 2025 for gambling machines. I think they're, and I don't want to go down this rabbit hole, but in the world of gambling machines, there are illegal machines, and then there's these things called sweepstakes machines, which are like, there's a very little difference. It comes down to like what's risk and what's luck.
Yeah.
So he was not meeting some codes in relation to what type of machines he could have and and not have. So he's got to deal with that right now. But he also, and this will bring us into the Eunices, he was a guy that had connections outside of just the Pittsburgh La Rocca crime family. He's tied into families in New York, the Lucchese's, mm-hmm. the Gambinos, De Cavalcante in Jersey. So let's go to Frank Eunice. And then from talking about, well, I guess it's Frank Eunice Jr. There was a Frank Eunice
Jr., yes.
Senior,
yeah.
who passed away a while ago that was in the rackets.
Mm-hmm.
Eunice Jr. is dead now, I think, as well.
Yeah, yep. Died right around kind of the same time as Sonny did, you know, that whole COVID.
It's 2020. Pandemic. I'm looking at it. He died in 2020.
Yeah.
And Sonny died in 21. So this is the group, what's ever left, I should say, of his inner circle, some kids, some nephews, maybe some grandkids, some other guys. I'm told, and I'll get into this in a moment, that Henin was kind of rolling with these guys as recently as the fall of 24, and trying to consolidate some gambling operations, shake some people down. I'll give it some more perspective in a moment after we talk about Eunice. So Frank Eunice Jr., mm-hmm. Aliquippa, Beaver County, Erie, Wheeling, had a, you know, had an imprint in a lot of different spots.
Yes. And mainly Aliquippa, but even some in Ohio as well. You know, if you're looking at the Pennsylvania Crime Commission stuff, they say that he was connected to Joey Naples as well over in Youngstown.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, you know, he, like these other guys, interconnected, also had ties to Paul Hankish in West Virginia, the Wheeling crew.
I'm looking at some notes. I had a file that said that he acted as kind of a go-between with some of the Pittsburgh leaders and what was going on in West Virginia.
Yeah, that could be true. I'll be honest. I don't remember that exactly. Yeah.
You're the expert.
He had strong connections to Hankish. And basically, you know, what we've been talking about, sports gambling and numbers. He lasted, you know, into the mid 2000s era, close to 2010 at the very least. He was also caught up in the 1990s busts. Didn't see a lot of jail time because there wasn't any allegations of violence. I'll say that there was a more recent, and by recent, I mean just post the year 2000. It's basically the last real act of violence where somebody could have been killed by a Pittsburgh mob associate in 2008. Basically, he had a gambling operation out of a storefront in Aliquippa. And I'm unsure of the details of what exactly occurred. I'm assuming there's a gambling dispute. And he allegedly shot someone who survived the shooting. Mm-hmm. They didn't die. One of the funny things, there's an article that describes the shooting and then also the gambling operation. And that, you know, it was clear that the media kind of staked out the place after the shooting happened and the police had locked up the door. And, you know, they said tons of people came by and tried to open the door, including one guy within 2 hour span, like came by three times and tried to open the door. Right. I just found that a little funny, like, you know, somebody who's so desperate to gamble, he's like shows up three times in 2 hours.
Right.
But that was to my mind, like, you know, a pretty significant event, like the last, it's not a hit. It just seems like a dispute that went a little too violent in the moment, right?
Okay, so let's and now I'm going to get into some stuff that you know, Paul does not, you know, he hasn't studied. It's only kind of come from my reporting. I just want Paul's insight on it. But if he doesn't feel comfortable speculating on it, you can say that and we'll go past it.
Sure.
But this is what, you know, when I heard about Henin and I heard about this, And the ESPN story doesn't mention any mafia angles or guys that Henin was connected to. I just said to myself after reading the Sports Illustrated reporting and talking to the guys that reported it out,
mm-hmm.
that there's absolutely no way he could have done what he's being accused of doing without some heavy hitters behind him. He was from Pittsburgh. So I figured there would be some ties there to Pittsburgh OC figures. And very quickly, I was able to find those ties. So let me just kind of sketch what I've learned. And that is, Hannon comes up, kind of mentored by some of these guys. Again, betting with them, helping them facilitate these people's gambling operations. He's also dealing drugs on the side, doing it in parking lots of sporting events and casinos. At some point, he gets run out of Pittsburgh. That he owes so many people so many money. He's upset the apple cart. This is in, let's say, the mid 2010s. He gets chased out of Pittsburgh. He lands in Philadelphia. After about a year or two in Philadelphia, he gets chased out of Philadelphia. Kind of the same thing. Got into some issues at a casino there. He lands in Las Vegas around the pandemic and reinvents himself as a social media personality. I have learned that around this time is when he starts putting things in place for what will be this giant point shaving scandal that will eventually, I'm told, include dozens of players, hundreds of games, from the highest level of the NBA to the lowest level of Division I college basketball. This was going on for 3 years. There were, again, you know, you're talking tens of millions of dollars, if not more, of bets wagered here. And that's not an easy operation to construct. And so this guy goes from like zero to 1,000. I mean, this guy's a brokester on the run, dodging people that he owes money to, that he's upset. And he puts in place this black market network, again, that goes from New York to LA. And I'm told that one of the ways he built this network was through youth basketball. That in the 2010s, he was staging AAU summer basketball events, building relationships with players that at that point were probably 13, 14, 15 years old, that are now, you know, 25, 26 years old and playing in the pros. And he joined forces with a convicted drug dealer down in Mississippi, who is also, I guess, in the social media gambling influencing space.
Okay. I'm told
this guy helped introduce him to athletes as well. So I think he was kind of building up this network throughout the 2010s and then unleashes it around 21. They start making a lot of money. He comes back to Pittsburgh and makes right, settles up, squares up with all these people that had run him out. And he comes back with money. that's the equalizer, right? Like,
it is, yeah.
We're all good. Once you pay me back and you give me the interest, like, hey, you can come back and do what you do. So he came, I'm told he came back, spread some of his wealth around. And then I'm told that as recently as 2024, he was going back and forth from Vegas to Pittsburgh and the Aliquippa area, and with offspring of Eunice Jr. and the Eunice crew, which was shaking people down, trying to consolidate a network of gamblers, bookmakers in the Pittsburgh area to pay some form of protection or tribute. Told, this is the last part I'm going to throw out of my reporting, and then I'm going to push it back over to you. I'm told that part of that play, the play of trying to get a bunch of independent bookmakers or semi-independent bookmakers in line, was being, at the very least, quietly co-signed by the Gambinos.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I guess what's your take on all that I just laid out about Hennin and kind of what I've discovered in my reporting? And the last thing I'll say.
Sure, go ahead.
I heard about this when it was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Like last summer, fall, I had some of my sources out in your neck of the woods reach out to me and tell me about this.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I don't want to say I dismissed it.
Yeah.
But it didn't mean much to me. And I didn't pay attention to the name Shane Hennin. Mm-hmm. Like, I just knew this guy was telling me a couple guys are going around trying to shake people down and get protection and line it up kind of like it used to be. Within a couple days of the ESPN story coming out, and I started digging around, the source comes back and says, "Scott, I told you about this last September. Go look at your messages. Look, I say Shane Hennin." And I go back and I look. I was like, "He did. He said Shane Hennin."
So, what I'll say is, you know, and not knowing any of what you just said, that's a surprise, but I'd say it's not an unbelievable surprise, right? Like, I heard from people back home that, like, there's still a ton of illegal gambling going on, obviously, and that, you know, especially in bars, the person I talked to specifically didn't seem to think it was anything organized. It seemed like people were just doing their own thing. And that could still be the case, right? I mean, like, if these guys were only focused on one neighborhood, that is what it is. But I always wondered why, you know, after they sort of committed mafia family suicide, why nobody ever kind of moved into Pittsburgh and was like, "Hey, you know, we're going to start making money here now too, because we know this is a gambling town." So it could be, you know, if you're, you know, it's like, you know, you watch the movie Donnie Brasco, you know, they're always trying to go outside of the New York, where everybody's fighting over $1, you know.
Yeah, right? Another great analogy. Go ahead.
So yeah, so like it can ring true, and you know, and just a foot stomp on the Las Vegas stuff too. Like Frank Yunis had connections in Las Vegas, so did Wango Capizzi. So some of those old Pittsburgh guys had connections in Vegas too. That this Hannon kid could have been aware of when he was hanging out. But yeah, I mean, that would be an exciting development, honestly. And I'll say another anecdote, more Pittsburgh specific. There was a cooperator in the 80s and nine, actually the 80s only. But he testified at the big Porter trial in 1990. His name was Marvin Drosnick, non-Italian associate.
Mm-hmm.
He used to hang out with Frank Amato, Jr., who was one of the main guys back then. And basically, he was sent into witness protection afterwards and, you know, ended up, I think it was Tennessee. I'd have to look it up, but somewhere out in that area. And basically, you know, all this stuff is in his blood. You know, he basically went into town, you know, where nobody had ever heard of the mafia before. And he's not Italian, but he immediately started setting up his own ring and, you know, with enforcers, and, you know, he got caught up in a murder for hire scheme. I mean, like, he just couldn't stay out of the life. And so when you think about somebody like the person we're talking about here, this newer player, you know, he flees from these different cities, but, you know, he's still trying to set up that network and, you know, have that kind of experience.
Pretty resilient.
You do what you know.
Yeah, exactly. You do what you know. And with him, I should also mention that I think part of the reason, and I know that this is documented, so I'm not afraid to say it. Mm-hmm. I've seen documentation of it in court filings. It looks like another reason that he left Pittsburgh was that he had possibly cooperated in his drug case against some of his co-conspirators. But once again, money can be the ultimate equalizer. You could come back and not just pay off the people that were mad at you for owing money. You could come back and be like, hey, I know I'm, and this is pure speculation, conjecture.
Yeah.
You could say, hey, I know I did this to you, but here's $500,000 for the hassle.
Yep.
Because there was, like I'm saying, this was a lot of money being mm-hmm. bet across the country, multiple brick and mortar casinos, multiple, apps on your phone, multiple street bookies. I mean, the money was being spread out.
Yep.
Another thing I was told was that, and I have not been able to confirm this, but I got this from a pretty good source. And then I was able to back that source up with one other person, but I always like to have three. So I wouldn't say this was rock solid confirmed, but mm-hmm. that it's possible that the bankroll, that Hennen's bankroll isn't coming from, let me back up for a second. So I don't want to conflate.
Sure.
The stuff that we were talking about, or that I was talking about in terms of this alleged attempt to line up independent bookmakers in the Pittsburgh area, mm-hmm. I'm being told could have or does have some backing from the Gambinos. Mm-hmm. That's not speaking to who was Hennen's bankroll for the point shaving conspiracy.
Gotcha.
Could it involve the Gambinos? Sure. But yeah. I have not heard that.
Yeah.
So I heard that the play to shake down a bunch of people in 24. And like you said, a lot of independent bookmakers, these guys had it in their head that we'll go in and take all these guys and make it kind of like maybe what it used to be, or a little bit more similar to traditional OC networking and stuff like that. But in terms of where the bankroll comes from for the conspiracy itself, I think that's still a question, and that's where I want to bring up two things as we wrap up here.
Sure.
And so one thing that I heard, and this is the thing that I heard from two people, but I haven't heard it from a third, so I don't want to say it's rock solid, but it's I think there is some part of truth to this, whether it's 100% true or 20% true. That there is somebody involved in this conspiracy. I don't have a name. Somebody that Hennen met through these mob contacts in his late teens, 20s, early 30s, mm-hmm. that left Pittsburgh voluntarily or involuntarily and is in Costa Rica right now.
Wow.
And he's an old Pittsburgh mob affiliate that very well, just like Hennen, might have got ran off. I'm not sure if he got ran off or he left voluntarily, but he lives in Costa Rica. And I'm told that Hennen has some contact with this guy and that the feds were looking into his connections to this person as possibly a source of money, if not the whole bankroll, parts of it.
Gotcha.
You have heard anything about guys going to offshore locations?
Not in any relation to Costa Rica or anything like that. Historically, there is reporting out there that some of the old bosses, like Mike Genovese, et cetera, did put their money overseas into Swiss bank accounts and offshore bank accounts and et cetera. But from my context, from the days that was being investigated, you know, over 30 years ago now, you know, they really didn't find, you know, too much out of that. You know, if they hit it, they hit it pretty well. So that is news to me.
Okay. So, two more kind of anecdotal things. One that's from the past and one just happened. Something that I heard, and this I have not been able to confirm other than hearing some rumors. And we were talking about, or you said, why hasn't another group come into Pittsburgh and tried to scoop up some of the independents or what the Genovese Sunny group had and doesn't have now. Mm-hmm. And I was told that the Gambinos had made a couple guys from Pittsburgh in the last decade or 15 years. Just, you know, bookies, not enforcers or anything.
Yeah.
And that they do have some action there. Now, I will also say that I talked to a couple people that are sources that I trust from that area, and they pushed back wholeheartedly on this. So I had two sources that told me, hey, and then I had two guys that are in there say, that is absolutely false. I would know that if that was the case. So just put it out there to say that maybe a New York family has empowered some guys there. Maybe that plays into what we're talking about. Maybe not.
I mean, that would be super interesting. But once again, I have not heard of that. But, you know, as we spoke about, too, like I do not have my finger on the pulse like you do. Kind of.
You're more of a historian.
I focus on the past.
Yeah. I'm a historian and a current day investigative reporter. So I check both boxes.
Definitely.
So last thing, and I guess this is kind of breaking news. I don't really want to go deeper than what we're going to discuss here for the next 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. I'll see how much more I can get on this, and maybe I'll put it out as an individual thing or as an article on my Gangster Report web magazine. But I have heard from good sourcing in New York that since this latest revelation that came out last weekend about Malik Beasley, and that this Beasley thing is tied into the Hennin thing, that some of the bosses in New York, some very powerful bosses in New York, have been having discussions about why haven't we seen any money from this? Like, how was this going on and we weren't in the know? Mm-hmm. There's, again, what I'm told is they're saying the same thing that I'm saying, which is you could not have done this without a huge bankroll. Mm-hmm. And people that had that bankroll having juice. I mean, this is just too large, too intricate. This wasn't some college kid in his dormitory having one of the star players that he has hamburgers with play around with a point spread. I mean, this is so the web is so wide, and mm-hmm. that you had some of these bosses being like, why are we hearing about this in ESPN? Like somebody owes us an explanation. And I think some of the, from what I'm told, some of the eyebrow raising is going towards the Gambino.
Gotcha.
Take it for what it's worth.
Yeah. I mean, that's very interesting, if true. I will say that they should be breathing a sigh of relief because, you know, now it might be getting unraveled. So.
Right. So Hennin is, that's the part that I think has just been said quietly. You got to kind of read a bunch of the story on ESPN to get to the point where it tells you, oh, Hennin got pulled off a plane in January for questioning. He had, I don't know, he had like $15,000 on him. Mm-hmm. He was headed out of the country. I think because he felt like the heat was getting, you know, the heat was getting too much and that he was eventually going to be arrested. He's pulled off the plane and they quote his attorney as saying, we're in conversations with the government now.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like without screaming that he's cooperating, they're telling you point blank that he's cooperating. Yes.
Yeah.
So I guess I my last question here to you, I've set up, this is my last question five times. but, and you can only speculate like I can speculate, but neither of us know.
Yeah.
I sense that we're only hitting the tip of the iceberg here in between now and November when the NBA and Division I college basketball season tips off. We're going to have a lot more knowledge and we're going to know a lot more about what Shane Hennon has been telling the government. I mean, Beasley is the first name we've heard get brought into this after we've learned that Hennon was arrested. Jontay Porter and Terry Rozier and the point guard at Temple, whose nickname was, I don't know his real name, but his nickname was Fab Miller. He was a leading scorer on Temple's basketball team in 24. He's alleged to have participated in this. He was pretty much kicked out of the NCAA, blackballed by the NBA. Now he's playing in Europe.
Okay.
What does your gut tell you in terms of, are we going to be hearing more about this or is this going to kind of putter out?
So based on what you're telling me, I think we'll hear more. I hesitate to put a timeline on it, you know, like knowing the inside of investigations and how they can be. So much can delay an announcement of more indictments, you know, whether or not it's his associates in Pittsburgh or Las Vegas or wherever, New York. If this is a huge sprawling investigation, it could take a long time and it could be years before you hear like exactly what's going on. Having said that, they also do want to mitigate the danger to the sport too, right? Like they don't,
I mean, that's the part
that I'm, of basketball.
I mean, I'm looking at the integrity of the sport that this thing looks like it dings so many, like a pinball machine, like just hitting so many people and programs and franchises. It appears to be at least. I'm surprised that they cleared Terry Rozier. So that tells me there are names being thrown into this where books that saw suspicious activity that reported it. Sometimes it was there was no there.
Yeah.
Terry Rozier had some suspicious activity on some of his over and unders. He'd been under investigation for over a year. He was mentioned at the forefront of the ESPN article, along with Jontay Porter, who's the only one that's actually been convicted of this. And we should say the people that were convicted with Jontay Porter are directly connected to Shane Hennon.
Okay.
And that's all known. And these are four or five guys that were Hennon lieutenants that have already been convicted in the Jontay Porter thing. But Rozier was cleared.
Mm-hmm.
Beasley comes in, Rozier goes out.
So it
just shows you kind of how up in the air this still is.
Yeah, definitely. And, and it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. It seems like it's going to be, you know, I mean, the only other infamous kind of point shaving scandal in Pittsburgh was the Henry Hill, Paul Henry Hill,
Goodfellas, Boston.
Yeah, exactly.
College.
Yeah. Which was not that successful. This one sounds like it was probably successful.
I think this was very successful until it wasn't. And who knows the damage that it could cause. I also think we'd be remiss for not saying that sometimes, and maybe this is too big to wrap your arms around, but sometimes the leagues themselves do what they can to mitigate fallout. I mean, look at what happened with Ohtani in MLB. You have the best player in all of pro baseball, where there's some real suspicious wagering going on with it, money coming from his account, directly from his account. It's hard for me to believe he didn't know that money was being gambled, but at the end of the day, the whole scandal, which could have, erupted ends and it peters out really quickly after it looks like it's going to become a five alarm fire. So I just want to say that it's very possible that even though this stuff could be true, because I think the Ohtani stuff is true, that doesn't mean that this scandal is necessarily going to erupt, because powers that be within the NBA, within college basketball, might just want to, you know, shield, you know, cover this up.
Yeah, I mean, if there's an investigation, that'll be hard to do. But, you know, at least limit the damage. I mean, that's what the private sector does, right? Not even just in sports. Like, if something happens, you know, your company gets hacked or something like that, you try to limit the damage before it becomes a headline, right?
Just seems so short-sighted. And we're learning a little bit more in the Detroit press about Malik Beasley, where, he was 24 hours away from signing a contract that would have paid him. The Pistons were going to pay him $15 million a year for 3 years. That would make a lot of your financial problems go away. But it's now being reported by the Detroit press that he had currently has quite a bit of financial strain on his salaries and what he's making. He's had to go for loans and pledge his salaries and put out things for collateral. That he's kind of in dire straits financially. So that might explain why you'd be more open to potentially, allegedly, or possibly manipulate a point spread or an over and under. But
yeah,
you're talking about guys, like I said, with Terry Rozier, you're talking about a guy, $100 million contract.
Yeah.
I mean, how much money can you be being offered to throw away? 100 million. It's not like it was in the 80s or the 90s where Michael Jordan was only making $3 million a year.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's no good reason for that. And
I'm just saying, there was a point in time where I could see you're a great basketball player, but you're only making $1 million a year, which was a high salary, and your gambling habit takes away $500,000 of that. So you're only making $500,000, and you have, you know, bills to pay or whatever. You're living above your means. So I can maybe understand how you, but now with the way that the contracts are in professional sports, where, you know, average middle of the road guys, Malik Beasley's a middle of the road guy, like a designated shooter, 10 points a game. He was about to make $15 million a year.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
it just seems like it's really short-sighted if you're playing Russian roulette with those potential salaries. And I mean, it's undisputed. If you get caught in one of these scandals, you're done. I mean, if you're convicted of it, you're done. You're blackballed from the NBA. You'll never play in the NBA again.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the integrity of the game is important. And like, if this has affected as many games as you're hearing, you know, like it could be a huge mess. But, and, you know, when you talk about short-sightedness, unfortunately, many people are short-sighted, so that doesn't surprise me either. If it was, you know, if all this is true.
I think Hennon has an assault, too. I should have said that at the beginning. I think he stabbed somebody or this is a cowboy. So, you know, this wasn't a guy that was known for his deliberate, savvy thinking. This was a guy that was a high roller and bet big and lived big. And he might be going down big. So, Paul, thank you so much for joining me. I held you for about 10 minutes longer than I wanted to. Go enjoy the holiday. Everybody out there, have a great July 4th.
All right.
Go check out Paul's book. Paul, let everybody know where they can consume your – you have two books, right?
Yeah. So the one that's related to the mafia is the one I'll mention. It's a Steel City Mafia, Blood, Betrayal, and Pittsburgh's Last Dawn. You can find it in bookstores in the Pittsburgh and Eastern Ohio areas, and then also for the rest of the country, you can get it on you know, Amazon and any other place where books are sold, Barnes and Noble.
It's a great book, a lot of great pictures, a lot of anecdotes that I didn't know about, some pictures I'd never seen. He's got some great photos from a meeting that took place between a number of different crime families that were photographed coming out of a meeting with some of the Chicago guys or some of the Pittsburgh guys.
Yep. LA and Pittsburgh.
Yeah. LA and Pittsburgh. And so thank you for joining me. Thank you for giving me your insight. If we get more on this story as it relates to Pittsburgh and The guys that we talked about, I will bring you back on. Really, this is the last question because it just popped. Is Eunice, are they Syrian or they're not Italian, right? Frank Eunice?
So as far as that family goes, the junior, the one we were particularly talking about, Frank Eunice Jr., he was half Italian on his mother's side.
Okay.
I'm not sure what the Eunice side is. That does sound kind of Syrian. And there is a Syrian Lebanese population in the Pittsburgh area. The guy we keep mentioning from West Virginia,
Paul Hankish.
Wheeling, he was Lebanese descent.
We have a lot of them in Detroit as well. A lot of the Middle Eastern immigrants came to Detroit, Cleveland, Pittsburgh for the auto jobs.
And the steel
steel mill jobs for you guys.
And and they had their own criminal groups too. A group that interacted with the mafia in St. Louis too, I think.
Yes, Jimmy Michaels. Yeah,
exactly. That's right. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I digress. I went down a quick rabbit hole there. So I held him for 12 minutes instead of 10 minutes longer. Thank you, Paul. Enjoy the holiday. Thank you, Benny, behind the glass for he's my MVP. He does all my production. And please like, share, and subscribe. Original Gangsters Podcast, Uncovering the Underworld, one city, one region, one country at a time. We're out.